Thanks for joining us for another edition of the Student Press Law Center podcast, a monthly rundown of news developments about the rights of people working in the student media. I'm Frank Lamani, Executive Director of the Student Press Law Center, and we are joined by two especially distinguished experts in media and First Amendment law who will be talking about a brand new court decision that ought to interest every college student with a Facebook account, which I guess means every single college student in the world. But first, we got a very sad reminder this week that the cases that we lawyers talk about, while they are about principles and standards and precedents, are first and foremost about real people. We're reminded of this because the student whose case we are here to talk about, Amanda Tatro, a 31-year-old studying to become a funeral director, was found dead by her husband on their living room sofa. Amanda had been suffering from a painful and debilitating neurological disorder, and although this is all brand new and the news is still coming out, the initial reports indicate that she died of natural causes at this very painfully young age. Amanda's death is a profound tragedy for her family, and it's frankly a little bit hard to sit here today and talk about her as if she is a case and not a person. We know that for the people who knew her, Amanda Tatro was much more than the name of a case, and we salute her for her fortitude in fighting for her First Amendment rights at what we now appreciate was such great personal cost. But we do need to talk about Amanda's legal case because it is a first, the first ruling to go all the way through the appeal process that addresses how much control a public university can exercise over what a student says on her personal webpage when she is off campus. This is an issue with profound implications for the ability of students to freely work on blogs or off-campus professional news sites or otherwise enjoy the full benefit of the First Amendment when they are not using their school's resources. And with us today to talk about what the Minnesota Supreme Court has just decided in the case of Tatro versus University of Minnesota are perhaps the two most knowledgeable and respected experts in Minnesota on the law of media and the First Amendment. Professor Jane Kurtley is the Silla Professor of Media Ethics and Law at the University of Minnesota School of Journalism and Mass Communications. She's also director of the Silla Center for the Study of Media Ethics and Law. She's a graduate of Vanderbilt University School of Law, and before coming to university in 1999, she served for 14 years as executive director of the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, an incredibly valuable resource for all journalists and also our suite mate here at the Student Press Law Center. Professor Raleigh Levine teaches at the William Mitchell College of Law in St. Paul, Minnesota, where she has been in the faculty since 2001. She's a graduate of Stanford Law School. She practiced law with the American Civil Liberties Union Foundation of Southern California before going into teaching. She was a law clerk with the Ninth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals, and before law school spent several years in broadcast journalism. Professor Levine assisted in preparing a brief in support of Amanda Tatro on behalf of the ACLU of Minnesota. So Professors Kurtley and Levine, thanks so much for sharing your expertise with us, and let us start with Raleigh Levine. Can you briefly set up what the Tatro case was about, give us some context, and describe the ruling of the Court of Appeals that led up to the June 20th decision from the Supreme Court?
Absolutely. So Amanda Tatro in 2009 was an adult student in her late 20s in the University of Minnesota's mortuary science program. Students in that program trained to become morticians and funeral directors. It's an undergraduate program, but people trained to become professional morticians and funeral directors. They take lab courses such as anatomy and embalming, and in those courses they work with cadavers that are donated through the university's bequest program. Before they take those lab courses, the mortuary science students sign a form indicating that they understand and will abide by the university's conduct rules regarding the cadavers, which are known as donors.
Right.
So while she was taking one of those lab courses and working on a donor, Amanda posted a series of satirical, sort of darkly funny comments on her Facebook page. The settings on the page made it accessible to her Facebook friends and also the friends of friends, so probably a few hundred people. And the posts were full of cultural references that people her age, her friends, would understand. For example, she referred to her donor as Bernie from the film comedy Weekend at Bernie's, about some kids who run around with a corpse pretending that he's alive. She joked about her work in the lab, talking about getting a chance to play with Bernie and how she might hide her scalpel in her sleeve if somebody tried to take it away from her. At one point, she posted a fantasy about stabbing her ex-boyfriend with a sharp embalming needle called a trocar, and she joked about how she'd miss Bernie when she'd no longer be working on him, posting Bye Bye Bernie, which was a reference to the musical Bye Bye Birdie, and Lock of Hair in My Pocket, which was a lyric from one of her favorite songs. So a fellow student in the program who also happened to work for the university saw the posts, reported them to the school. The school became concerned, particularly about the jokes about stabbing her ex-boyfriend with a trocar, hiding the scalpel, and called the police, and also suspended Tatro while a police investigation was pending. And Amanda Tatro was quite upset. She was making jokes. She didn't think she was threatening anybody, and she spoke to the press about the incident. The police determined that Amanda had not committed any crime. They agreed her comments were jokes. She didn't pose any real threat to anybody. But the school then instituted disciplinary proceedings against her and concluded that her comments were disrespectful and unprofessional, and thus violated the conduct rules to which she had agreed when she signed up for those lab courses. And her punishments included receiving an F in anatomy lab and being put on academic probation for the rest of her time in the program. Mm-hmm. She appealed to the Minnesota Court of Appeals on the ground, among others, that the university had violated her First Amendment speech rights. And that court disagreed. That court held that even though her Facebook posts were made online, off campus, without use of the school's computers or servers, and even though she was an adult, not a child, the school had the authority to discipline her for her speech because her comments were, the school said, threatening and disrespectful, and thus violated school rules. Now, just a little legal background. The general rule for government regulation or sanction of adult speech is that the government entity, here a public university, must have a compelling reason for restricting or punishing speech, and the means it chooses must be necessary to achieve that compelling goal, meaning that the means chosen do achieve that goal and that it can't be achieved in any less rights-restrictive way. And also the means must be narrowly tailored to achieve that goal, meaning that they don't sweep in and punish too much speech that's otherwise constitutionally protected. As most people know, the U.S. Supreme Court has held that speech is somewhat less protected in public elementary, middle, and high schools because of the unique disciplinary and pedagogical concerns of school administrators at those levels. And in a series of four cases, starting with the 1969 case Tinker, the U.S. Supreme Court has held that such schools, elementary, middle, and high schools, may punish or restrict student speech if it causes or is likely to cause a material and substantial disruption of schoolwork, interfering with classes or keeping students and teachers from being able to do their work. The Court of Appeals reasoned that Tinker applied at the college level, even though the U.S. Supreme Court has refused to so hold, recognizing the difference between college students and middle and high school students. The Supreme Court hasn't yet issued a decision, but it has, that's squarely on point, but it has issued a number of opinions that point out the differences between college and middle and high school students. Unlike middle and high school students, college students are adults, not children. They're fully independent. They're able to vote and often drink. College administrators don't share the disciplinary needs or pedagogical concerns of administrators at high schools and middle schools. College administrators don't act in loco parentis and the parents in the stead of the student's parents the way they do at the high school level and below. And the Court of Appeals, in addition, determined that even though the lower courts are in wild disarray on this issue and the U.S. Supreme Court has yet to issue a decision on the matter, that Tinker and the other high school student speech cases apply to online, off-campus, outside of school hours speech.
Right. Yes, let's go ahead at this point and jump ahead to Jane Kirtley and her description for us of the what the state Supreme Court holds. So the Court of Appeals says that this speech is punishable under the Tinker standard, meaning that it was substantially and materially disruptive of school activities. They hold this both because it alarmed a student enough to complain about the possibility of violence, and also because it alarmed the prospective donors to the anatomy program who threatened to potentially withdraw their loved ones' donations or their own donations. So now we get to the state Supreme Court. Can you explain what they held and on what legal basis?
Well, there was only really one issue before the Supreme Court directly, because Amanda did not raise any non-constitutional issues. Her focus was specifically on whether what the university had done had violated her First Amendment free speech rights. And in a really, I think, very interesting decision, the state Supreme Court declined to apply Hazelwood as the university asked it to do. It declined to apply Tinker as well. It said neither of these standards are applicable in this particular case. What we're really talking about is a very specific, very narrow situation where the students enrolled in the mortuary sciences program basically sign off as condition of taking part in the anatomy access program, an agreement that they will treat the cadavers with the utmost respect and dignity, and that they will be careful about their language outside of the laboratory, and that they recognize that blogging about that lab or their cadavers is not permitted. And essentially what the court said was, in that specific context where the university is enforcing a professional rule, it is appropriate for it to discipline students who don't follow that rule. So it really was, as I said, a very narrow ruling that I would hope in the future would be applied only in very specific areas. Of course, the devil's in the details in a situation like this. As somebody who teaches in a journalism school, I immediately started thinking, well, is somebody at the university now going to say that the Society of Professional Journalists Code of Ethics is a professional code that is enforceable and that the School of Journalism or the university should be disciplining students who don't follow the SPJ code when they're posting on Facebook or writing their own blogs or something like that. My hope would be that courts in the future will only be looking at specifically the kinds of unusual situations, medical school and health sciences kinds of programs, and utilize those kinds of codes of conduct as the only ones that to which this would apply. That doesn't mean that I personally think that they ought to be able to police what students are saying in their non-university blogs or Facebook posts.
I think, Raleigh, are you with us?
I am, yeah.
Yeah, I think we just Jane was just cut off while talking. Hopefully, she'll dial right back in again. Let me get you to sort of pick up at where she left off and just talk a little bit about was this creation of a new standard that is pegged to following established professional standards and giving a college disciplinary authority over speech that is found to be violative of established professional standards. Was that sort of a legally permissible outcome, or was this a court freelancing and drawing up a play with its finger in the dirt in the sandlot?
Yeah, I mean, I think the latter. I think that, you know, what the court did here was sort of invent, seemingly out of whole cloth, a special standard for students in free professional programs. And I think what's Professor Kirtley is correct to note the narrowness of the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision. Although it applies in few cases, in those cases in which it does apply, the court gives even less protection to adult college student speech than to high school student speech. College student speech to be punished, even if it doesn't cause and isn't likely to cause a substantial disruption of schoolwork or classroom activity. So it comes up with this bizarre result where adults get less speech protection than high school students.
Right.
Do.
Now, it's a very, very interesting result. And as Professor Kirtley was saying, one that although the term professional standards is used, it's really not clear, right, whether this is going to be a standard which applies only to people, let's say, in a pre-law or a pre-med program, or whether it's going to be something that applies more broadly to sort of acts of unprofessionalism, right, which could be acts by people who are studying to be teachers or studying to be nurses or law enforcement or any other profession, right?
Hi, Frank.
Right.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but I'm back. I don't know what happened.
Yeah. Well, we were just actually, Jane, talking about the point that where you left us was the idea that it's possible to apply the new TATRO standard, the quote-unquote established professional standards standard, to disciplines beyond law and medicine and things that we think of as professions. And that would be the potential concern, I suppose, for all students, would be the risk that, let's say a photo on Facebook of you sipping a margarita might be considered now to be violative of the professional expectations, say, for a school teacher, and you may find yourself in front of the disciplinary board explaining that margarita photo.
Well, exactly, and I think the bottom line is this perennial question we have, which is what constitutes a profession, and the more broadly that term is interpreted, and when journalists try to call themselves professionals, they may be leaving themselves open to that situation. So, I think this is not an unsubstantial concern, but I would emphasize that the important point for me about this decision was that the court's decision ultimately turned on this narrow category. It did not have the kind of expansive interpretation that either the university or, frankly, Amanda Tatro had been trying to argue.
I would just say, I would add that I don't think it even goes so far, properly read, as to apply to law schools. I think that in large part the court emphasized that its decisions stem from the unique relationship between the school and people who donate cadavers, since they may not donate if they don't feel that their corpses will be treated with dignity and respect.
Well, I would agree with that, although I do think that, although that was something that the university certainly focused on very much in the case, I think that, the impact in terms of adverse effects for the university, whether it was money donors or cadaver donors, didn't seem to me to be a driving force in the court's decision here. I think that they, and that to me is a positive thing, because the last thing that I think we would want is a principle that says that students who say, quote-unquote, disrespectful things on their Facebook pages, and as a result, donors don't want to give money to the university anymore, could be subject to discipline.
Right. That's right.
Sure.
I mean, I also think that there's an additional problem here. Even granting the focus on the professional conduct rules, and that is the equation that the court makes between conduct and speech. Everybody, I think, would agree that mortuary science students couldn't claim First Amendment protection for conduct that is undignified and disrespectful to a corpse, playing with a corpse like the kids in the Weekend at Bernie's movie,
right,
desecrating a corpse. But the court's interpretation of this standard would allow, for example, a licensing board to punish a funeral director who, at a cocktail party, made a joke about the appearance of a corpse on which she was working without in any way identifying the corpse. And that's essentially a decision that government entities may sanction speech simply because it's disrespectful or undignified or offensive, which is something that the U.S. Supreme Court has repeatedly said violates the First Amendment. You cannot constitutionally restrict or punish speech because it's offensive. And bottom line, that's where I think the court has gone very badly wrong.
Right. I wonder what your thoughts are, and this is sort of two-parter, and either of you is welcome to address this. First, on this idea of almost sort of privatizing the standards of the First Amendment here, right, that speech may be deemed to be constitutionally unprotected speech based on a standard that is set by people who work for, you know, a medical association or work for a bar association, work for an association that is a private standard setting body outside of government. That's one question. And the other is this idea that we have to punish in order to teach, because that was sort of very implicit in the message that came out from the University of Minnesota in reaction to the decision, was welcoming this as empowering the university to teach. But of course, I think there's a real question whether the ability to kick somebody out of a program is necessary to teach, right?
Well, I'd like to pick up on that point, and Raleigh may want to talk about the first part, because as somebody who teaches at the University of Minnesota, I've been concerned about how the university was going to be interpreting the general code of student conduct as well as the specific kind of disciplinary rules that are specific to a particular program. I personally think that the university has been overreaching for some time in their passion to try to ensure, I guess, that students at the University of Minnesota are Minnesota nice 24/7. And the question that I really have is you know, when is this house of cards going to collapse? The bullet, I guess, was sort of dodged in this particular case because the state Supreme Court hung its hat so specifically on these disciplinary rules and didn't have to get into the broader question of whether something like the student conduct code would be an acceptable way to justify punishing students for off-campus speech. But, you know, I would certainly agree, and I think that the position that the university took would be this, that, you know, they did allow her to remain in the program. She did get her degree. She was not expelled from the school, so this was an important teaching exercise. You know, I'm not saying that it's never appropriate for a university program to discipline students who deviate from professional standards of conduct that they're being held up to. I think that it is part of the teaching process. As somebody who was involved in a plagiarism matter here on campus earlier this year, I certainly wanted the university to treat seriously a student in the journalism school who had violated what I consider to be a fundamental rule of the profession.
Sure. Sure. Well, let me just ask by way of wrap-up for Professor Levine, any thoughts about the precedential value of this case going forward, particularly this is a state court construing the federal constitution, and it was a very unusual posture where you had several fill-in justices appointed, so you really didn't even have a majority of the sitting justices on the Minnesota Supreme Court. Is this a case that you think is going to have a lot of force and vitality going forward, and do you think it is one that could potentially become sort of a bellwether, an early standard setter to which other courts in other jurisdictions will look?
Well, I hope not is the short answer. I mean, I think that, again, you know, it's a quite narrow ruling. The court did not decide that the Tinker line of cases applies at the college level. It didn't determine the extent to which school administrators can restrict online off-campus speech. It emphasized that a university cannot make a student's waiver of speech rights a prerequisite of attendance in any course, and it did several times emphasize this unique factual setting. So I think that properly construed, it has little precedential value, both because of what the court explicitly said and, as you say, because a number of the sitting justices recused themselves because of their connections to the University of Minnesota.
Yeah, any thoughts on that, Jane? Interested in your take on that.
Well, I would agree, but I think as we've learned from other cases, and I'm not talking about specifically student speech cases, but I'm thinking of the Hitman Manual case a number of years ago involving the book that supposedly taught people how to commit murder. Mm-hmm. The judge who wrote that opinion said this is a very narrow situation that only applies in a very specific set of facts, and yet that case took off and was applied in other situations decisions where that court had never even intended it to apply. So, you know, the devil's in the details in a situation like this. I agree a state Supreme Court is certainly not going to be binding precedent anywhere outside of Minnesota, but given the number of university groups that were involved in this case as
right.
friends of the court, I expect that it will have legs. We'll just have to see what happens.
Right. Now, we certainly saw sort of the head table of American higher education participated as amicus on behalf of the university. And so certainly one would assume that those associations are widely circulating this opinion. And the next time they have a disciplinary case with First Amendment implications, they will be trying to use it in their own states. I think there's no doubt about that. Well, with that, let me give our thanks to Professor Jane Kirtley of the University of Minnesota School of Journalism and Communications and to Professor Raleigh Levine of the William Mitchell College of Law. And I want to thank you both for contributing to the public's understanding of a case that may come to have significance in the development of the law of online speech and college students' rights. For those of you listening who are interested in learning more about the Tatro case or about the free speech rights of college students, we hope you'll check out the resources available at www.splc.org and that you'll call or write the Student Press Law Center if you have any questions about your legal rights as a journalist. Our free attorney hotline is always ready to take your questions. It's 703-807-1904, and our mailbox is always open at splc@splc.org. Thank you for listening.